Okay, we're continuing with our investigation of the matter of the Israelite conquest and the exodus from Egypt, probably the most complicated area in biblical studies today. We've seen that what had been the traditional dating of the 15th century, 18th dynasty of Egypt, ran into a great deal of trouble when archaeology began to be very active in Canaan, or rather should say Palestine, especially in the 1930s and 1940s, because there were so few positive matches between the accounts of the Bible relating to the conquest and what could be shown to be present archaeologically. And that as a number of cities began to be uncovered that were destroyed in the late 13th century, people began to feel that this was the proper time setting for the Israelite conquest. And of course, they began to seize upon Exodus 1:11 with its mention of the city of Ramses. And instead of viewing the mention of the name Ramses in the text as an editorial updating for what had been the name of the city in the days when the Israelites were there, they began to say, no, wait a minute, that's not an editorial updating. That's what it was when the Israelites were there. They were there when Ramses was there in the 13th century. And we've been looking in the wrong time. And now that we know where to look, we see in these destroyed cities in the late 13th century the evidence of Israel's conquest. The problem was that though there are a lot of destroyed cities in the late 13th century in Canaan, they don't match the list in the Bible any better. And that essentially we have the same three matches which we had with the earlier date, and either cities that did not exist, making up the majority of the rest of the list, or in the case of two places, cities the Bible claims Joshua destroyed, notably Hebron and Debir, having been in existence. We're not positive about Hebron, but there seems to be enough evidence to indicate that it was in existence. And Debir, instead of being destroyed, was blithely going on its way without any interruption in its settled life. So there was no evidence of any fall of the city in that time period. So just having destroyed cities is not enough. You've got to have the ones that match the Bible, if we're going to accept the Bible at all. And so, as I mentioned last time, with all these problems with the archaeological record of the 13th century and the biblical account, people began to look in other directions and say, well, the biblical account is so faulty, there's no way of possibly working with it. We should just dispense with it and view it as the work of later writers who didn't have the foggiest idea of how Israel entered the land and what they did. They misconstrued things terribly. They thought they came in and conquered the place, and they were totally wrong. What they really did was to move in, infiltrating into the hill country, settling down rather peacefully in the open areas among the cities. And it was only after a period of time that they came into conflict with the settled community. And the real conquests that are mentioned in the Bible are those that occurred not even in the 13th century, but occurred later, in the 12th century, maybe even in the 11th century. Now, many people have become quite titillated with this new theory and are very fascinated with what it offers, but this is not one universal acceptance by any means. A very interesting article, though not in every sense correct, appeared in the March-April edition of 1982 of the Biblical Archaeology Review. A very important Israeli scholar, Abraham Malamet. His primary expertise is not so much with the period of the conquest as it is with the period of the monarchy. And his main reputation has been established with his very insightful analysis of the relationships between the Israelite kingdoms and Egypt on the one hand, and the Israelite kingdoms and Assyria and Babylonia on the other. A very fine scholar in that area. However, he's turned his attention to the conquest, and although he does not accept the biblical account as accurate, in fact, in his article, which I will come back to at a later lecture, he makes a very peculiar observation about the book of Judges and the book of Joshua that very few scholars would make today, showing you that even a very good scholar can have his blind spots. But he turned his hand to this matter of the Israelite conquest in writing this article for the March-April 82 issue of Biblical Archaeology Review. He entitled it, How Inferior Israelite Forces Conquered Fortified Canaanite Cities. And the chief point of the article that I want to focus upon is his main thesis. He says, and I'm quoting from page 25 of that particular issue of the magazine, both the infiltration model and the revolt model hold some truth. No doubt some peaceful infiltration and settlement occurred. No doubt there was dissension and some insurgents in the Canaanite cities, with some Canaanites even joining forces with the invading Israelites. Consider, for example, Rahab, the harlot, who led the Israelites into Jericho, and the informer from Bethel, who showed the Israelites the way into that city, which is mentioned in the book of Judges, chapter 1. But there is a third model, the biblical tradition, per se, that describes an outright military conquest of Canaan. And this third model cannot simply be discarded. He says what people are doing with these new theories about the infiltration model, the peasant revolt model, is to basically throw out the entire biblical account, lock, stock, and barrel. He says you can't do that. You just can't simply discard it. Without accepting every detail of the biblical account, it is nevertheless clear that alongside a peaceful settlement and some unrest and revolt, there was Israelite military action which achieved a forceful penetration into Canaan. And he goes on page 26 to make this statement, which is certainly true. A basic element of the Israelite consciousness is that Canaan was inherited by force, whether this force was an act of God or of man. This tenet is like a leitmotif that runs through the biblical sources. And he's quite correct. It's not just in the book of Joshua and the book of Judges, but elsewhere in the Bible, constantly one is running back into this theme that the Israelites took the land by force. It just runs as a common thread through almost every major book of the Bible. And he is saying that you just can't ignore that. No matter what you might conclude about the truth of Israelite conquest, he says, at the core, a military conquest remains. No matter what you might say it consisted of, you have to accept the fact there was a military conquest. In part, because the accounts in Joshua and Judges reflect an intimate and authentic knowledge of the land, a knowledge of its topography, and how that topography relates to military strategy. There is an intimate link between the topography of the land and the military strategy, it says, the Israelites employ. And I'm quoting again, which strongly support the conclusion that the settlement of the Israelites in Canaan was accompanied by substantial military operations. Now, what does he mean when he says that there is this authentic knowledge of the topography and it is interwoven with their activities in taking over the land in the biblical accounts? Well, first of all, we do have at the very start, even under Moses' leadership, the fact that the Israelites were located at Kadesh Barnea and began to move towards the land of Edom, initially hoping, of course, to pass through it, and that their presence near the southern border of Canaan excited not only the antagonism and hostility, but probably the fear of the king of Arad and led him to make an attack on the Israelites. And then, of course, after being defeated, the Israelites destroyed the two cities of Arad and Hormah that are at the top of our list. This is mentioned, of course, in Numbers chapter 21, and in Deuteronomy, the first chapter. So there is a recognition of the landscape in the way of Atharim, the way the spies went up to investigate Canaan. The Scorpion's Pass is a significant route into the southern region of the country, the biblical Negev, and therefore, the presence of the Israelites near this area was very disturbing to the king of Arad, as it should have been, since his job was, so to speak, to guard the southern portions of the country. Then we have the fact that when the Israelites do make their move across the Jordan River, no action is taken by the Canaanites to stop them. They are free to move across without any hindrance. And yet, in other instances in the Bible, we read about how, because the Jordan is a barrier, it can only be crossed at a few places, action was taken to control those few places to prevent people from crossing. For instance, we'll see later when we study the activities of the judge Ehud that the fording places of the Jordan near Jericho were taken, and as a result, the Moabites were trapped west of the Jordan River. In a second instance, we'll take a look at later in the campaign of Gideon, the fords of the Jordan were again taken in a different place to prevent the Midianites from escaping. And then finally, I think we're familiar with the account of how after the campaign of Jephthah, there was a disagreement between the Ephraimites and Jephthah's people over, you know, the disposition of the spoils, and it came to warfare between the tribes east of the Jordan and the Ephraimites. And the Ephraimites tried to escape westward across the Jordan, and they took the fords of the Jordan and asked them to pronounce the word Shibboleth. And the Ephraimites had a regionalism. They didn't say Shibboleth, they said Sibboleth. And so every time they questioned somebody who was suspicious, they could always find out if it was an Ephraimite or not. But the point is that they could control the Jordan crossing points, and that prevented them from making good their escape. Yet the Canaanites take no such action. Now, this reflects an understanding of the nature of Canaanite society in this period. They were divided up into mutually suspicious city-states. They were not in the habit of taking joint action, and so there was no joint action to prevent the Israelites from passing over the Jordan. This is reflected in the nature of the political organization and military organization of Canaan, that normally they did not take joint action. We also find that the biblical account in both Joshua and Judges specifically mentions that the focus of the Israelites' activities in terms of conquest were the hill country and the foothill region we call the Shephelah. This is mentioned in Joshua chapter 17, where we find the house of Joseph kind of grumbling about their lot. In verse 16, Joshua 17, verse 16, the children of Joseph said, "The mountain country is not enough for us. And all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both those that are of Bethshan and its towns and those that are of the valley of Jezreel." In other words, they were complaining that they had been able to occupy the portion of their inheritance that was in the hill country, but they feared to go down into the valley and oppose the Canaanites because of their use of military chariots. Well, Joshua spoke to them and said that the mountain country in verse 18 shall be yours. Although it is wooded, you shall cut it down, and at its farthest extent it shall be yours. And that eventually he meant you shall drive out the Canaanites so they have iron chariots and are strong. And eventually that was indeed true. They did do so. But initially they did not. So this does reflect something which is probably, as Malamud says, he has no reason to question it. Chariots would have been a formidable problem for the Israelites, but the chariots are of value in the plains and valleys. They're not really of much value in the hill country. And therefore, the Israelites were successful in occupying an area of the country where they didn't have to contend with large-scale chariot forces. The same thing is said in the book of Judges, chapter 1, where in the case this time of the tribe of Judah, in verse 10, it says that Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. The name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, and it mentions that they were successful against these places. And then they went on to Debir, and it mentions the account of that. And we'll have a reason to come back to this, because this seems to be a doublet of what is mentioned in the book of Joshua. But in verse 9 it says, "Afterwards, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains in the south," meaning the Negev, "and the lowland." That's an unrelated thing to what happens in verse 10. "And they were not successful, though. They were not successful. Notice verse 19. The Eternal was with Judah. They drove out the inhabitants of the mountains, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. So, this again. Why is it in the text that they had an easy job of clearing the mountain country and difficulty with the plains and lowlands, unless it's reflecting some sort of accurate historical memory? Because by the time supposedly these accounts were written, Israel possessed all of the land. If they were going to make an account of out of whole cloth of how their ancestors had come in and conquered the land, why should they have supposed they had difficulty anywhere? Since as long as they could remember, they had the whole bit. Why suppose that initially their ancestors could only get the mountains? Obviously, the only explanation that makes sense is because that's what they did have. They only had the mountains. They didn't have the plains and valleys. That what it says in the text reflects an historical reality and not just fiction. Notice also how Gilgal appears in the text, the function it seems to play. Notice in Joshua that it's, of course, their first beachhead that they established west of the Jordan. That they crossed the Jordan River and they established themselves at Gilgal. Now, this, of course, appears in the text in the very early parts of Joshua. Let me just find it here. In chapter 4, I think it is, yes. They crossed the Jordan. In verse 19, the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. Now, after their campaigns, notice what happens, especially after the campaign against Jericho. Where do they go after they have successfully reduced the city of Jericho? What is it that they do? They come back to Gilgal. This is where they are pictured as being in chapter 7. They then begin to reconnoiter the area of Ai. They have their initial campaign where they are unsuccessful. And then, of course, they go on in chapter 8, as we read the second time, to successfully take the city of Ai. But after they had done that and completed their renewal of the covenant on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, what did they do? They went back to Gilgal. And it is here in chapter 9 that the Gibeonites come to trick them into making peace. They go right back to their camp at Gilgal. Then, of course, they have to help the city of the Gibeonites against their being attacked by the neighbors because they had made peace with Israel. But after that particular campaign against the kings of Jerusalem and his fellows, what do the Israelites do? Chapter 10, verse 15. Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal. We also read this in verse 43, that after they conquered the cities of Libna and Lachish and Eglon and Hebron and Debir, all those places, what did they do again? Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal. It constantly comes up this way. And this is logical. If you look at a map of the land, you can see that Gilgal is located right near the Jordan in the vicinity of Jericho. It gives them not only a safe base camp, but it keeps them in contact with the area across the Jordan they had totally subdued, where they left their wives and little ones, at least the ones of the half-tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Gad and Reuben. And they have a base where they can use as a basic supply depot and a route to penetrate the hill country through the many wadis that run up from the area of Gilgal to the central spine of the country. This makes good military sense. That located between the city-state of Shechem and the city-state of Jerusalem, you have this area in the middle, which is sort of no man's land. This is the area that Israel was able to penetrate. And so it reflects something that makes a great deal of sense militarily. Then the text itself is very rich in military stratagems used by the Israelites. For example, notice how often it mentions their use of spies on reconnaissance missions. They send spies even from the desert before they enter Canaan up to spy out the land. Of course, that resulted in the bad report, remember, in the 40 years of wandering. But when they eventually do enter the land, notice the incidence of the mention of spies. At Jazer, across the Jordan, Numbers 21. Numbers chapter 21, verse 32. Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and they took its villages and drove out the Amorites who were there. It doesn't make a big deal about it, but it does give us a mention of the use of a reconnaissance mission before the actual battle. We find this at Jericho in the book of Joshua, very well known. We don't have to even turn there. How the spies enter the city, not just to find out the disposition of the troops and their numbers, but also the morale of the people. And of course, Rahab hid them and helped them to escape. So there was an attempt to assess the situation by the use of a reconnaissance mission. And then, of course, in the case of Ai, that a small group of scouts went up to Ai and assessed the situation. And they came back and they told Joshua, look, it's a smaller place than Jericho. You don't need a big military force. Just send a small group. That'll be enough. You see, this was their report from that reconnaissance mission. Now, this is, of course, makes solid military sense. And it seems to indicate that you have something rooted in reality. In fact, as Malamud mentions in his article on page 32 of this magazine I've been quoting from, even if Israel was not unique in the employment of stratagems in warfare, no other literature of the ancient Near East equals the books of Joshua and Judges in the number and variety of battle stratagems that are described. It is just replete with details about these battle stratagems. There are only two cases where Israel directly faced a large body of Canaanites. In all other instances, they either had cities that had no troops left to defend them, or they used stratagems, either with God's help or without. For instance, with God's help, they had the stratagem of the walls of Jericho falling flat, you see, which opened up the city. But in the case of Ai, we've already talked about it, they went up the second time. They pretended to be afraid of the men of Ai. They fled away. They enticed the men of Ai away from their city. And then a small group that Joshua had placed there in advance, in ambush, came into the city, which was left undefended and probably open, and they destroyed the city. And then the men of Ai saw the smoke of their city rising up, and they were very distressed. And then the ambushing force came down to meet the Israelite force that had been fleeing and turned around, and they caught the men of Ai like the filling in a sandwich. There was no place they could go because they were going down a very narrow defile chasing the Israelites. And so when the other group came up behind them and the Israelites they were chasing turned around to face them, there was nowhere they could go. They were just trapped and they were all killed. So again, we find this usage of these stratagems. Only two instances where they have a frontal attack, and in both cases, although of course God was working for them, you find evidence of the fact that there were stratagems that were employed as well, especially the stratagem of surprise. This is in the case of the battle at Gibeon, where, remember, they had to go up and help the Gibeonites because they were under attack by their Canaanite neighbors. And it mentions specifically in the text, in Joshua chapter 10, Joshua, verse 9, Joshua therefore came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal, a distance of approximately 20 miles, ascending up 3,000 feet over a distance of 20 miles. They accomplished it all at night and arrived either just at dawn or very soon after dawn, when the sun was just sort of low in the eastern sky. Now, how do we know that? Because it says in verse 12 that Joshua spoke the Eternal and said, "Sun, stand still still over Gibeon and moon in the valley of Ajalon. Now, Ajalon is west of Gibeon. If the moon was in that part of the sky and the sun was in the eastern part of the sky, what time of day do you have? You've got a situation of early morning when the moon has not yet set, you see, in the west. And so, if you picture the scene, the Israelites appear suddenly without any warning. The Canaanites are arranged in a sort of a siege around the city of Gibeon. The Israelites appear over the hills from the east. The sun is behind them, so that when they turn to look at where all this noise is coming from, they can't even see clearly because they're blinded in part by the sun. And out of nowhere, seemingly, this force of Israelites comes pounding down upon them. And maybe I'm adding a detail from my imagination, but I don't think it would be necessarily wrong. Perhaps with their own version of what is commonly called in America a rebel yell that probably chilled their blood no small measure. It's no wonder that they panicked. This was nothing they had prepared themselves for. And they fled. And then, of course, Joshua pursued relentlessly after them. Because now that they had them in a state of panic, if they didn't capitalize on the situation, naturally the advantage would be lost. And that's why he asks God for the miracle. Make the day last long enough so we can catch up to them and really wipe them out. Of course, God not only did that, but he also sent down huge hailstones to kill the fleeing Canaanites as well. And so we have, again, a certain success that is granted not only through God's intervention, but by using certain valid military tactics. The second frontal assault, you might say, against a large Canaanite force is at the waters of Merom, which is mentioned in Joshua chapter 11. This is where the kings of the Canaanite cities in the north gathered together, and they were going to jointly fight against the Israelites. And again, the account mentions the matter of surprise. Joshua chapter 11, verse 7. Joshua and all the people of war with him came against them suddenly by the waters of Merom, and they attacked them. And the Eternal delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them to Greater Sidon, to the brook Misrophet, and to the valley of Mizpah eastward. They attacked them until they left none of them remaining. Again, the battle plan was the same. Pursue them relentlessly while they're in a state of panic and disorder, so that their superior numbers is not a significant factor. If you have a disciplined, well-organized, high-morale group of troops facing you, you've got a problem. When they're in a panic and they're fleeing with complete disorder, each man thinking of saving his own skin, it neutralizes the effect of their numbers, and you can attack them much more successfully. Now, all of these details as brought out by Malamed, I think, are valid, and they point up again the fact that I think he's making, is that these things are the unlikely sort of stuff to appear in an account which is made up out of whole cloth, especially since they give a very strong implication, and that is that the children of Israel were not horrendously numerous as compared to their Canaanite foes, that it was a combination of their stratagems and God's intervention that gives them the victories in these cases. Centuries later, when Israel filled the countryside, it would have been hard for them to imagine that they were anything except a humongous people. They would not have pictured an account of a conquest in this fashion. They would have just probably pictured it overwhelming by massive waves of human attacks, these huge fortified cities. They wouldn't have built up an account that shows so strongly their need to rely upon stratagems that enable a smaller force to overwhelm a larger. And of course, this relates to the whole question of the numbers of the Israelites, which I will give you a handout about later. Not that I want to be dogmatic on the point, but I think there are a number of points in the scripture that point in the direction that Israel was not as numerous as we might have been led to believe in the past. I'm not saying it dogmatically. I'll leave you to make your own decision after you've read the material I'll be providing you. Okay. Malamed's point, then, as I've explicated it, is that the biblical accounts have too much in them to admit of anything other than a real conquest. But where then do we put it? We seem to be at a standstill. In fact, James Pritchard, one of the leading scholars of this period, remarked in a book that he wrote on his excavation at Gibeon that based on the archaeological evidence of Jericho, Ai, and Gibeon, and I'm quoting now from what he wrote, it suggests that we have reached an impasse on the question of supporting the traditional view of the conquest with archaeological undergirding. In other words, he's saying, I don't know how we can buttress the account of the conquest with archaeological evidence. We're at an impasse. Okay, here we have the situation then. The archaeologists have told us there is no archaeological support for a conquest in the 15th century BC. They said that the evidence is much better for the 13th century BC. Upon closer examination, however, that supposedly better evidence for the 13th century BC is not any whit better than the evidence for the 15th century. And in fact, there seems to be a number of glitches, you might say, that have led archaeologists to throw up their hands and say, there is absolutely no support for a biblical conquest at any time throughout this entire span of time from the 15th through the 12th century BC. And consequently, no less a personage than the vice president of the American Schools of Oriental Research at their annual meeting a few years ago said, I no longer believe that there was such a thing as an exodus from Egypt. I no longer believe there was such a thing as an Israelite conquest of Canaan. Well, obviously, we are not about to imitate his sentiments. We do believe in the historical accuracy of the Bible. But the point is our belief in the historical accuracy of the Bible defensible? Can it be defended in a rational way? Or do we simply have to say, well, it's just a matter of faith? Well, I think it can be defended in a rational way. Let's go back and look at the evidence for the 15th century date and consider what supposedly is this horrible mountain of evidence that says the biblical material cannot be correct. Quickly then, reviewing the biblical evidence that points to a 15th century date for the Exodus and a 15th century date for the conquest, separated by a period of 40 years. 1 Kings 6, verse 1, tells us that Solomon, in the fourth year of his reign, began the construction of his great temple. And this was 480 years after the Exodus. Now, there is some debate about when Solomon's fourth year was, but we can pin it down to within a few years of approximately 965 BC. So it's a simple matter of adding 480 years to 965 BC to find what date 1 Kings 6:1 is telling us is the date for the Exodus. And so we come out with 1445 BC, a date nicely in the middle of the 15th century BC. In Judges, the 11th chapter, in verse 26, we have another important statement. In this particular chapter, Jephthah, the judge that God had raised up at that time, was confronting an Ammonite threat to the Israelite lands that Israel possessed east of the Jordan. The Ammonites were claiming that the land was theirs and that Israel was not in lawful possession of it. And Jephthah, in the diplomatic exchange that took place prior to the actual fighting, says in verse 26 of Judges 11 that Israel has been in possession of these lands for 300 years. Now notice, he doesn't say that it's been 300 years since we came up out of Egypt. He says we have been in possession of these lands for 300 years. In other words, he's saying the conquest of these lands took place 300 years ago. Now, archaeologists and biblical historians are pretty much in agreement that Jephthah lived approximately at 1100 B.C. Consequently, 300 years before that would be 1400 B.C., a date at the end of the 15th century B.C., and a date just about 40 years after the date which 1 Kings 6:1 indicates is the date of the Exodus. And so you can see this is the date the biblical text clearly points to, the 15th century B.C. Now, why, according to the archaeologists, is it impossible for the 15th century to be the date? Well, they say 1 Kings 6:1 is fine, Judges 11:26 is fine, but let's look at Exodus 1, verse 11. In that particular verse, it mentions that the children of Israel were building the store cities of Pitom and Ramesses. Now, Pitom is not really an issue. There are a number of sites, some of which, indeed, would conform to a 15th century date, where the biblical Pitom could be located. The big problem is the site of Ramesses. According to the biblical historians and archaeologists, and when I use that phrase, I mean the majority of them, not necessarily all of them, but the majority, the only Ramesses this city could mean is the city of Per-Ramesses, built by the great pharaoh Ramesses II. And the great pharaoh Ramesses II did not live in the 15th century B.C. He did not even live in the 14th century B.C. He lived in the 13th century B.C. And so, therefore, a 15th century date for the Exodus is an impossibility. Well, how solid is this evidence? Are they correct that this is the only conclusion one can draw? Well, let us look at another scripture, Genesis 47 and verse 11. The context of this scripture is Joseph, who is arranging for the settlement of his brethren in the land of Goshen in order that they should be close to where he is working and living. In this particular context, where he mentions the area where his brethren are to be settled, he says that he placed his father and his brethren and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses. Now, Joseph is obviously much earlier than the 13th century. There's absolutely no way you could place Joseph at the time of the great pharaoh Ramesses II. So how is it possible for the mention of the land of Ramesses to appear at the time of Joseph? Well, all the scholars are of the single mind. What you simply have here is an editorial updating that Ramesses II was such an important pharaoh, and he built such important cities and other structures in the Delta region that the area of biblical Goshen came to be known from the 13th century on as the land of Ramesses. And so simply what happened here is we have an editorial updating of the text. Now, that's not very strange at all. We've already encountered such an editorial updating of the text. Remember when we were talking about Abraham and how he pursued after the kings who had captured Lot, that it mentions in the text in Genesis chapter 14 that Abraham pursued them as far as Dan. Well, obviously, there was no city called Dan in the days of Abraham. The city had another name. What we have there is an editorial updating so that the Israelites would have no doubt as to where Abraham caught up with the four kings. And so in Genesis 47, all the scholars agree, you have a similar updating. Well, we might say, if they're willing to accept that the mention of the name Ramesses in Genesis 47 is an editorial updating, why are they so opposed to the mention of the city of Ramesses in Exodus 1:11 also being an editorial updating? Well, the scholars seem to have a good reason, at least on the surface. In order for the mention of this city in Exodus 1:11 to have been originally something else, and then to have been editorially updated to the name of Ramesses, it must be the place where Ramesses built his famous city, and it must be true that centuries earlier,
before Ramesses built his city, there existed on the same spot an earlier city that was built by the Israelites. And the scholars say, absolutely, this cannot be so. They have excavated under the remains of a place called Kantir today, which they know is the remains of the cities of Ramesses. And nothing exists under the city of Ramesses except for an earlier city that goes back into the 17th century BC, a city which came to an end in the 16th century, a whole century before Israel could have been at work building the city. In other words, approximately 1550 BC, this city ceased to exist. It was the capital of the Hyksos, the foreign conquerors of Egypt. They were thrown out of Egypt in 1550 BC by the very pharaoh, perhaps, who began the enslavement of the Israelites. And then that city was left to rot. And so, therefore, nothing existed there until in the 13th century, Ramesses built his own city. However, what these scholars are failing to notice is that archaeological excavations have been done immediately to the south of the remains of Ramesses cities in a suburb called Tel El Daba. And interestingly enough, in this adjoining suburb, the suburb that adjoins the ancient city which Ramesses II built in the 13th century, there are remains of a city that was built in the 15th century. And even more interesting than the fact that there are remains of a city from the 15th century is the fact that the population that lived there was clearly of Semitic origin. And that is particularly important because obviously the Israelites are Semites. And so really, when one examines it more closely, the archaeological evidence does not make it impossible for this area, later known as the city of Ramesses, to have been the site of a city built by Israelites in the 15th century. The evidence at Tel El Daba quite likely is the remains of the city the Israelites built, which later came to be called the city of Ramesses. Let's take up now another supposed proof that Israel could not have carried out an exodus and a conquest in the 15th century BC. This is the evidence supposedly brought forth by Nelson Glick in his famous survey of archaeological sites in ancient biblical Edom and Moab. Glick wrote up the results of his work. He conducted a survey of these areas. And he concluded, and he wrote this soon after he did his work in the late 1930s, that it is impossible for the events detailing Israel's contact with Edom and Moab, which resulted in Israel being forced to detour around the national territories of Edom and Moab, it is impossible for this event to have taken place in the 15th century. Because, according to Glick, there was no settled population in Edom and Moab in the 15th century. That if Israel had come knocking on the doors of the territory of Edom and Moab in the 15th century, there would have been no answer. There would have been no one home. There would have been nothing to prevent them from using the king's highway as they desired. There would have been no need for them to circumvent the territories of Edom and Moab. Well, it's interesting that this conclusion of Glick still appears in the literature, even in articles that are written in, let's say, the 1980s. I say it's interesting because Glick himself wrote in 1974 that this conclusion of his was totally wrong. Glick was forced to take this retraction, to make this retraction, I should say, because beginning in the 1960s, the early 1960s, a number of other archaeological surveys were done in the biblical territories of Edom and Moab. They were done by highly qualified excavators, and it was a more thorough survey than Glick's original survey. And the conclusions of these surveys supported and backed up by later surveys, even in 1975 and again in 1978, were that there was a settled population in Edom and Moab in the 15th century. But it was not a large one. In fact, now the archaeologists and biblical historians that oppose the 15th century date have slightly changed their tactics. They've been willing in the main to admit there was a settled population there, but they say it was too small to have forced Israel to have gone around the territories of Edom and Moab. Well, this is really even more surprising. In the light specifically of a scripture we find in the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 2 records for us that Israel sought permission to go through the territories of Edom and Moab using the king's highway. And they were not permitted to do so, and they had to go around. Let's notice the reason why. The Bible nowhere says that Israel went around Edom and Moab because they were inferior in numbers and strength to the population of Edom and Moab. In fact, the Bible says the opposite. Notice in Deuteronomy chapter 2, beginning in verse 4, God is speaking and he says, "Command you the people, saying, you are to pass through the coast of your brethren, the children of Esau, which dwell in Seir. They shall be afraid of you." It makes it very plain. Edom was not more populous than Israel. Edom was weaker than Israel. That's why they were afraid. But God says, "Take good heed to yourselves, therefore. Do not meddle with them." In other words, don't engage them in battle. "For I will not give you of their land, no, not so much as a footbreadth, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau for possession." Notice that the same thing was said about Moab and the children of Ammon. In verse 19, "When you come nigh against the children of Ammon, distress them not, nor meddle with them, for I will not give you of the land of the children of Ammon any possession, but I have given it to the children of Lot for a possession." Again, the statement is made clearly showing that if Israel had engaged in battle with them, or as it says in verse 18, the coast of Moab, they would have won. They would have dispossessed these people. Notice in verse 9, "The Lord said to me, distress not the Moabites, neither contend with them in battle, for I will not give you of their land for a possession." God is making it plain that unless he had forced Israel to go around, the Israelites would have overwhelmed these scattered peoples of Edom and Moab, defeating them in battle and taking possession of their territories. And so really the archaeological evidence that shows that in the 15th century B.C. there was a small settled population in Edom and Moab conforms exactly with what the Bible tells us. It does not contradict it, as many biblical historians seem to claim. Let's now turn to one last matter that historians and archaeologists tend to raise as supposed proof that Israel could not have carried out a conquest in the lands across the Jordan in the 15th century B.C. They point in Numbers chapter 21, verses 21 through 31, the account of Israel's military campaigns against the territory of Zion, the king of the Amorites. And in the context of this campaign, where they came into possession of the land that belonged to the Amorites, it is mentioned that they destroyed the cities of Heshbon and Dibon. They're both mentioned together in verse 30. Now, archaeologists have located an Arab village known as Diban, an Arabic village called Hesban, and as you could expect, these seem to be very good toponyms for the ancient cities of Dibon and Heshbon. And they have excavated at these sites and indeed have found the ancient capital cities of Heshbon and Dibon. However, there was a big problem. These cities were founded on virgin soil in the 9th century B.C. There is no way they could have been inhabited in the 15th century when Israel came through here. And so obviously again they say the text is wrong. Well, you know, it's very interesting. It appears that when some scholars find evidence that seems to contradict the biblical text, immediately they jump to the conclusion the text is wrong. But yet, when they find evidence in secular historical records that seem to contradict the archaeology, they don't say the historical records, the secular records, are wrong. They simply say, well, we don't have a complete archaeological picture yet. Now, this to me, I think, is a clear evidence of bias. That if it's a case of the Bible being in contradiction to the archaeology, well, then it's the Bible that's obviously wrong. The archaeology is perfect and complete. But if it's secular history that's in conflict with the archaeology, well, our archaeological findings are not yet complete. As I say, this is clearly bias. And this applies specifically to the case of Hesbon and Dibon. Or rather, specifically, I should say, Dibon. Because in the 15th century, the pharaoh, Thutmose III, records on his documents in Egypt, on the walls of the temple, that he conquered the city of Dibon. And in the 13th century B.C., the great pharaoh Ramses II makes a similar claim. Now look, 15th century, 13th century, both pharaohs claiming to have captured Dibon. And yet the archaeological evidence says the city was not founded until the 9th century B.C. The archaeologists do not deny the truth of the statements of Thutmose III. They do not deny the truth of the statement of Ramses II. They simply say there must be a place nearby where these cities originally were located at the time of Thutmose III and Ramses II. And all I'm saying is, why can't we use the same standard when we are dealing with the biblical text? Why not just say that the cities of Hesbon and Dibon were located somewhere near their later locations, and that the Israelites conquered the earlier locations of Hesbon and Dibon? It certainly would be reasonable for us to take this position, since this is the position afforded in the case of the missing cities of Dibon for Thutmose III and Ramses II. Indeed, we know of other instances where cities seem to have traveled somewhat in a general vicinity. And this would not be without precedent. And so, I'll leave it at this. The general point is there is nothing per se that has been advanced in terms of archaeological evidence which convictingly proves the 15th century could not be the time of the biblical exodus and the conquest of Canaan under Joshua. However, there is still the matter to be addressed of the fact that the cities that are mentioned in the book of Joshua, that Joshua conquered, and which appear in a summary form in Joshua chapter 12, that these cities are mentioned as being conquered and destroyed. However, we lack archaeological evidence to confirm all but possibly three of these conquests for the 15th century B.C. How do we explain this lack of evidence? And even more surprising, the seeming evidence for the non-existence of certain cities like Jericho and Ai, and the seeming evidence for the continued existence of certain cities that the Bible claims Joshua destroyed. We'll begin to approach this matter in the next lecture when we consider the Bimson hypothesis. Dr. Bimson is a man who did some interesting work on this matter in an English university. I don't think he has the correct answer, but I think he significantly points us in the right direction, and we'll evaluate his hypothesis beginning next time.